Hello. So you're all here, hopefully, for Hilton 201. This is software fan fiction. I'm not exactly certain the title was something like Jailbreaking iPhone Mobile Fan Fiction for Mobile or something like that. My name is Jay Freeman, but most people online know me as Sorek. So I'm going to do a quick introduction of who I am. So if you don't know why I'm here, hopefully you'll know by the end of that. So I'm Sorek, and a couple points to make on me being Sorek is that I am not Spock's father. I don't have to say this to this audience, I think, but this is actually a really common problem where people will say, "Oh, I know Sorek, that's Spock's father," and I'm like, "No, actually, that's Sarek." I'm also not Torek. That was an ensign on Star Trek: The Next Generation. I'm just in general, I'm not from the planet Vulcan. And I apparently you have to say this. Somebody actually said that already as I was sitting up here. You will note that is not how you play a violin. This is actually this is the picture of me. I actually do at least sort of know how to play a violin, but I'm not that good at it. But people talk to me all the time about playing violin. But most importantly, I am a computer hacker. That's why I'm here. I'm kind of like. Occasionally, I kind of channel the stereotype of the computer hacker from the movie, where I'm like sitting in the middle of the massive light show, programming on something that's affecting people all over the world. This is actually what was happening behind me. This is just a few weeks ago in Vegas. But most of the time, my job is almost not even development. My job is community management. So what I do is I travel around to conferences like this, and I do outreach to users and developers, explaining what it is that I do and why I think it's important. I have been doing this since early 2009. This is one of the, this is like the second talk that I gave. The previous one, a really small one, just a couple weeks earlier, and that's what really brings me here today. So, what is it that I do? I work on Cydia, which is the alternative to the App Store on jailbroken phones. So, the App Store is something that actually, I should stop. How many here know about the App Store? Okay, great. I've been doing this so long that sometimes I just like, "Do you know about the App Store?" And they actually say no. And then I'm like, "Oh, okay, we'll see this." All right, so the App Store has got this issue that people like to talk about where applications get rejected from the App Store. And that's where everyone always looks at me and they say, "Oh, you solved that problem, right?" So whether it be a web browser from Firefox, whether it be a actually pornography application, whether it be anything that Apple doesn't want, Apple says no to it. And then people say, "Oh, you bring it to Cydia." So there's a quote I found on some webpage, "Once rejected, Talkin took its business elsewhere, offering the app up for the jailbroken gray market." So I always take issue with this characterization because I think this misses the whole point of what jailbreaking is and what Cydia is. So now let's go into that a little bit. Jailbreaking is about when there isn't an app for something. It's not about you made an app and then Apple rejected your app. Apple actually honestly has reasonable reasons a lot of times for rejecting applications. I mean, sometimes it's bothersome that they are using a single value system. In the case of pornography, well, why is that actually like such a serious problem? Why is Apple rejecting that? It's a problem that they use a single legal basis. You might be doing something that's totally legal in the Europe, and Apple's like, "Well, I can't do that in the United States." Some things involving celebrities and portrayal of them, etc. And so you might be bothered with that. But by and large, a lot of the stuff that Apple ends up rejecting is rejected due to quality. It's rejected due to the application just actually being a scam, and Apple's taking money, etc. for it. What Cydia is primarily focusing on is all the stuff where you wouldn't have been able to deploy it to the App Store in the first place. There's no process by which you could give it to the App Store. Instead, I would say that we are a feature store. We're a place where you can go, and instead of downloading an icon that represents a totally different world on your phone, where you can go in and you can browse Facebook, you can browse LinkedIn, you can go and you can order pizza from somewhere. Instead, maybe you'd like to get a change to the operating system, something that normally you'd have to wait for Apple to release a new version of iOS for. You can get it now. You can get it today. Maybe it's free, maybe it's for pay. We're also not about free software. So, Winterboard is an example where people will go through and they will change all of the graphics and icons on their phone. So in this case, we've got a custom icon theme where all of the icons are this cool transparent effect, which of course works really well with the with if you have the right kind of wallpaper. But you can also get new functionality. So in my previous screenshot of the Cydia store, we had five icon dock was something that was about to be installed. Well, here we've got five icons at the bottom instead of the normal four. the functionality can get kind of crazy. This is something called Barrel. So Barrel is a way of doing transitions between pages on your phone. So when you've got your home screen, you've got all your icons, and you swipe left and you go to the next page, Barrel will fade between the icons, or it will do a 3D rotate effect between all of the icons. Maybe you swipe horizontally, but it moves them vertically. My favorite effect is this one, which is the kind of the title effect. It's all of the icons manipulate themselves into a circle and roll off the screen, and then another circle of icons rolls on the screen and then kind of expands back out and fills the grid again. But it's not just features that are in Apple's operating system. We also can have modifications to third-party applications. So here's a feature that somebody added to the YouTube application called YourTube, which adds a download video button right into the interface. These kinds of modifications are something that then are just become very pervasive. You can do them to anything on the system. All right, so again, though, I mentioned that, you know, it's taking things that Apple would be doing at some point, and you can kind of get them now. Well, if we look at a lot of the features in iOS 8, these are features that you've actually been able to get from jailbroken devices now for a while. Third-party keyboards, quick reply for messages, renaming message threads, always on Siri so that you don't have to like hit the button in order to get it to listen to you. Embedded photo editing, supporting Touch ID and applications. The people who work on these software modifications are at the forefront of innovation of what the features of the operating system will be. And you can actually imagine, I mean, Apple can use us as like a testing ground. You can see what worked, what didn't, what was confusing, what wasn't. And you'll oftentimes see features that we've released a couple years later ending up in Apple's operating system in some interesting, refined manner. Sometimes it's not as complex or as full as the feature in Cydia, but in a way that's kind of the point, is that they figure out how to target the complete end user experience on that. So the way we do all of this is using a technique called runtime code modification. Which is something that I provide the features for in the community, a library and framework called Substrate, which is designed to make it both easy and safe and hopefully in a way where multiple developers don't step on each other to make these changes. In a way, my kind of inspiration for this is when I was a kid, I had a Game Genie. How many people here had a Game Genie? A lot of people had a Game Genie, or like a Game Shark, or there were a few other iterations of this. Game Genie was a device that connected into your Nintendo, and it sat between the cartridge and the game console. And it was actually kind of awkward because the way the Nintendo worked is you kind of slid the cartridge in and then depressed it down into the machine, and there wasn't room for the Game Genie, so the cartridge would kind of still be sticking out of the machine and everything. But it provided an interface when you first turned on the console where you could configure it. And then the configuration would intercept the download of the program code from the cartridge and change individual bytes of data that was stored on the cartridge as the device read it. It was a way where you could change the code of the program that you're about to run. Now, it's something where a lot of people even had a Game Genie, didn't really understand what it was doing or why it was doing that, because there were these opaque codes that you typed in that were like 6 or 8 digits long, that were a bunch of letters. But there was a scheme you could decode them, and you could figure out that was actually change this address of code to this different byte of value. And what that allowed you to do is to do anything from making Mario always invincible to never being able to die to having him swim through levels where he's not even underwater. Because there's just all of the comparisons, all of the checks in the code, you're able to control all of them. Now, one thing I like to sometimes think about this is, in a way, it's kind of fan fiction for software, and that's actually the title concept of this talk, is that you have a developer who's constructed an application, and they have a vision of where they're going with it. You can actually think of it as the original canon for this like universe of this thought process, this application idea. And they're in control of how it gets released from release to release. And in a way, they're the characters and the features of the application of the product are things that only they're allowed to manipulate and control in the release process. There are a lot of people, however, who would like to see something a little crazier. They would like to see features put in different ways that the original developer maybe was a little uncomfortable with. And so there's some things like being able to download a YouTube video as an example of somebody maybe actually being uncomfortable with something. Or it could just be something that just didn't really make sense. I mean, some fan fiction doesn't always make sense. It doesn't have to make sense. It's something that the person who's writing, the person who's reading it enjoys. And so you might come up with a feature that sort of makes sense to you, but doesn't make sense to anyone else. And the original developer is never going to try to add this kind of feature. You might go even further, and you might start trying to do mashups between different features of different different products, trying to blur between Touch ID and the password authentication from Facebook. You might be trying to take functionality from Twitter and add it into another application. It starts to look like remix culture, where you've got software and you've got a bunch of ideas floating around in all this software, and you as the person who's experiencing the software, you take all this software and you're kind of smashing it all together and changing it and making it yours. You're making it sound the way you want. You're making it, you're taking the pieces and components and building something really awesome and cool out of it. So these interesting, like, well, these interesting to me, these interesting copyright ramifications that come out of some of these things. There's another analogy I want to use, which I never get to use, because I always say to people, have you heard of Stargate SG-1? And my audience are all like high school students and early college students, and they all say no. And I'm like, what? I'm to the point where it's just like, this is one of the, to me, this is a recent television show that is one of the, like, one of the last well-funded science fiction shows. And it's like, if you're interested in science fiction, how could you not have watched this show? But then they're like, no, I haven't seen this show. So in Stargate SG-1 also, of course, you know, the sequel, Stargate Atlantis. I'm actually going to start there for a second. So the Atlantis Gate was this really awesome thing, right? It had this massive computer associated with it, and it was all designed by the people who designed the Stargate system. And they had all sorts of cool functionality in all sorts of systems. But it was only in Atlantis that they actually had this kind of gate. Everywhere else, there was this stupid normal gate. The normal gate didn't really do much. It allowed you to go from one place to another place using this thing called the dial home device, which was a very easy system. It was an easy end user interface, fast automatic activation, but it had very limited functionality. You could dial a gate address, it would open a wormhole, you'd go there, everything else was fairly automatic. This is a kind of, to me, feels very similar to the experience where you've got like an iPhone and you talk to people at Apple and they're like, oh, we do all sorts of really cool stuff. Oh yeah, we had an emulator running on the iPhone long before you guys even figure out how to hack it. And it's like, yeah, well, the device you gave me didn't even run any games. It didn't even have Tetris or like Worms or Snake or whatever on it or anything. But the thing that I always found exciting, I actually found Atlantis to be a little more boring, honestly, because I was always fascinated by the Earth Gate. The Earth Gate was somebody took a normal gate and then figured out how it worked. The quote from the television show is they spent 15 years building a supercomputer, whose goal was to power this gate. And we then have Walter instead of the DHD. Walter is our interface for manipulating the gate. He's a dedicated operator, and the gate itself has a slow manual activation process. I mean, literally, right, it's like it's an analogy to a rotary dialing a telephone as opposed to having a touch tone. It has a lot of advanced functionality, though. I mean, like, they're actually able to see what's going on inside of the gate as the wormholes are getting constructed. They're able to use this in order to, for example, automate the process of constructing this massive metallic iris, which, of course, it's just such a hack, right? I mean, it's like we don't want things to go through the wormhole, and so we figure out a way to put this massive metal shield on it. So, such a hack. Kind of people who build these silly hacks are these crazy hacker types. So we're going to shift gears again here. What my next slide is. Oh, yeah, so these crazy hacker types build all this stuff. And the kind of the attitude that we have going into constructing these kinds of things is a little bit awkward. And so this actually got brought up in the television show. The gate wasn't meant to be used without a dialing device. This is Rodney McKay. Your computer system ignores 220 of the 400 feedback signals the gate can emit during any given dialing sequence. It is a fluke that you picked up the buffer warning. For that matter, I'm surprised you even bothered to abort the dialing sequence despite the error. This kind of like hacky attitude is something that you see of a lot of computer hackers, where we kind of get it to work. And you know, the Earth Gate is really cool for me because it has so much advanced functionality, but it's also really cool for me because it only just barely works. And all right, so in order to make all this kind of stuff happen, though, we end up going in and we end up ripping apart, understanding, and manipulating. We end up tampering with a lot of systems. And so this is also why we have this quote here: "Is that I'm surprised you even bothered to abort the dialing sequence despite the error." It's like there's actually this kind of serious warning that the gate had that the computer system was that the norm of the DHD would actually like control correctly and handle for and everything. But somebody kind of tampered with it and messed with the whole thing. tampering is something that there are actually laws against. So there's this Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which has an anti-tampering clause in it, which states that if you have copyrighted works that are protected by a it's actually been so long since I said this word, so I'm blanking my head. An effective anti-tampering device. And so you always question, like, was it really effective in the first place? But against an effective system, that you aren't allowed to take that effective system and remove that that protection from that copyrighted work. And the question then starts to become, well, if we're sitting around and doing all this cool software, I mean, what we're doing is we're trying to change the behavior of software. We're not trying to steal software. We're not even really affecting Apple's business model, honestly, because we're not even competing with them on apps, things like that. But in order to do that, we have to remove the mechanisms that are protecting Apple from things like piracy. We start falling under things like the anti-tampering clause. And this is why the Electronic Frontier Foundation is so kind enough to have me on a track like this, is that this is what they're constantly looking at, is issues in technology where the law is saying things that doesn't really seem to match the morals or values or even what we actually, our hopes of the user communities. And so the Electronic Frontier Foundation here, of course, defending rights and promoting freedom. They were working with, again, in the DMCA process, every 3 years there's an exemption that you have to put forward. And so the exemption process is actually really irritating. So the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, when they put it out, it became very clear that, well, this is going to affect a lot of things we want to have. One of the, like, saddest examples of this is if you're blind and you want to be able to get an audio interface of a book that you have on an e-reader, you should be able to read the book. If the book has only come out in electronic format, I would like you to eventually be able to read that book. And in fact, the laws were set up in a way where that was considered a legitimate usage for something like this. Whereas now every 3 years we have to go and we have to fight for exemptions again on things like allowing people to get audio recordings from books that have been distributed in electronic formats. We have to get fair use for educators to be able to utilize even the little 30-second clip they've always been supposed to be allowed to utilize in the course of their classes, because those are now distributed on DVDs, and the DVDs have an encryption mechanism that has been effectively nothing since 2002 or something like that, when DVD John figured out the way the encryption works. But it's still something where we have to keep going and asking, like, can we still have this exemption? And they say yes. And there's a ton of money and a ton of process that goes into doing this every 3 years. So the this was the 2012 hearings. I was actually at the 2012 DMCA hearings. I was in the audience, this picture that I took. This is a lawyer from the EFF, Marcia Hoffman, who's sitting in the, she's in the, you can't even see this picture anyway because it's such a faded out picture, but she's in the gray suit over on the right of the picture. Okay, so I guess these slides are a little bit order interesting. So I was going to say then, another example of where you might have heard a lot about this is with the PlayStation 3 hack from Fail Overflow. So the PlayStation 3 hack was a really popular, it was a really mainstreamed case involving the DMCA and issues with that. Although, honestly, that never actually came to that. So we ended up having the actual Sony versus GeoHot battle, and it was entirely a battle of jurisdiction. So we never actually managed to learn anything interesting about any of these laws or how they might affect anything. Sony Online of California really wanted it to be Sony Online of California sues Punk Kid from Jersey, whereas GeoHot really wanted it to be local hometown kid gets sued by massive Japanese mega conglomerate. In the massive battle that ended up pursuing, there were issues were brought up, like, well, where was GeoHot collecting PayPal donations from? Did he have a website? Were servers located in California? Were any of the people who gave him money located in California? It got to the point where the judge in charge of the case was, I'm really uncomfortable with the idea that anyone with a website who uses an online mechanism for getting payments of any form suddenly has jurisdiction in my court. But in the end, we didn't even learn that because they settled out of court, and we don't really have any clue, of course, what they settled for, because that was also all covered up, etc. But arguably more fun was it kind of turned into this epic rap battle, right? Did anyone here actually see this video? Nobody here saw this video. So we may or may not actually be able to get audio from here.
Yo, it's GeoHot. And for those that don't know, I'm getting sued by Sony. We'll take this out of the courtroom and into the streets. I'm a beast, at the least you'll face me in the Northeast. Get my ire up, light my fire. I'll go harder than Eminem when at Mariah. Call me a liar, pound me in the ass. I'm no Luke Chafin. You're fucking with the dude who got the keys to your safe, man. Those that can't do bring suits, cry to your Uncle Sam to settle disputes. Thought you'd tackle this with a little more tact, but then again, fudge packers, I don't know jack. I shed a tear every time I think of Lickstang. But shit, man, they're a corporation, and I'm a personification of freedom for all. You fill dockets like that's a constant bar to y'all. But lawyers, muddy water, and TRO stall. Out of business is jail to me, you're suing me civilly. Exhibit this in the courtroom. Go on, do it, I dare you.
So the reason why I will say this actually turned into such a horny issue is that the is piracy. So with the case of something like a PlayStation, Sony sells a PlayStation below cost. They sell it as a loss leader for actually getting games. So you'll then go and you'll go try to buy games, and the games will have a royalty arrangement with Sony in order to when every copy that EA sells, they have to give some percentage of revenue back to Sony. And if you try to take their hardware and you start doing a lot of stuff with it that doesn't require you to start going through either the game manufacturers anymore, because like the big ones that have licenses with Sony, because you're able to deal with independents, or you're able to start stealing video games, which of course is a problem just in general for other business reasons, that drastically affects Sony business model. I mean, you imagine the worst case scenario, everyone in the world buys a PlayStation. Like, I'm actually not kidding. Worst case scenario, everyone in the world buys a PlayStation, because are they going to buy games with it? If not, Sony just lost hundreds of billions of dollars. So we've not had this kind of issue with Apple, which is I think important to point out, because Apple does not sell any of their hardware at a loss. Apple actually, if you look at like their App Store, the amount of money that they make on a sale of an iPhone is 100 times what they're making off of the number of apps that people are actually buying on those phones. So. And we actually got a good comment from the Copyright Office, Library of Congress. While joint creators raised concerns about pirated applications that are able to run on jailbroken devices, the record did not demonstrate any significant relationship between jailbreaking and piracy, which is kind of nice. So we did get an exemption. We got the exemption in 2009. It got renewed in 2012. But the exemption was for computer programs that enable wireless telephone handsets to execute software applications, where circumvention is accomplished for the sole purpose of enabling interoperability of such applications when they have been lawfully obtained with computer programs on the telephone handset. So Apple TV, our same tools for years worked on the Apple TV, but the Apple TV is certainly not a wireless telephone handset. The Apple TV, however, also starts to run into the problem of are they actually selling this thing at the right price? The Apple TV is actually kind of an interesting one, where, as far as we understand, they bin chips. So what that means is that when they make an iPhone, like the current, like really good version of the iPhone, like right now the iPhone 5S, not all of the chips work, because sometimes when you're putting billions of transistors on something, some of them are broken. And so it's a dual core chip. If one of the cores doesn't work, they can't use it in an iPhone 5S, but they make the single core Apple TV out of a dual core iPhone 5S chip with one broken core that's turned off. So it actually is, when you look at the price of some of these things, it's like, well, the price of this device is actually kind of cheap, and even though it looks like it's got, like, it's like the same as an iPod, but it's got like a bunch of extra connectors and a bunch of extra stuff on it, just doesn't have the screen, well, the screen expensive, et cetera, but it's because it's using broken parts. But even the iPod Touch, and this is the one that really, really makes me sad, is that the iPod Touch isn't covered, because it's not a wireless telephone handset. The one, though, that gets a lot more press is that the iPad isn't covered. It's also, of course, not a wireless telephone handset. I mean, even to some extent, it has cellular connectivity in it. It's not a handset, right? And so it's something where, well, maybe there's some arguments that can be made in court, et cetera, like that. But we really like to get an actual exemption on it. So this is a 2012 hearing where one of the people who was on the Copyright Office panel, though, held up a Kindle, and he was just very upset about the idea that if we got an exemption for tablets, then we would also get an exception for Kindles. Now, I kind of feel like the Kindle should be exempt, because the Kindle to me is another computer, and I think that all these computers should be exempt. But the business model argument is that this is a device that is only designed for providing ebooks, and that Amazon could be giving this away for free, right? And that again, we run into this kind of scenario where people get unhappy, they get upset, and maybe there will imagine lawsuits down the road, things like that, if you start targeting these things in too large quantities. But the guy on the copyright panel was actually just, he was adamant that he didn't want to accept a definition of tablet that would also include a Kindle. Line gets so blurry. So here's the Amazon Kindle Fire, right? The Amazon Kindle Fire is essentially now an iPad. I mean, it's got all the app functionality. It's got the, music videos. It's got a full color LCD screen. It's running Android. It's a computer, right? But so now the question is that how are we going to succeed in figuring out ways of defining tablets such that the Copyright Office is actually going to be happy with this? Everyone is really puzzled about this, including here Newt Gingrich. He did a little video that kind of went viral for a while, mostly making fun of him. But I actually think that it's like, because people are saying that he doesn't like the fact that this is called a cell phone, and that I was actually kind of upset that people were making fun of him so much, because the point that he was kind of getting at was that by defining this computer that is in our pockets, that defines everything in our life, that stores all of your, not just address book information, but stores all of the communication you've ever had with any of those contacts, that has all of these photographs you've taken, the video recordings, audio recordings, all of the stuff that's in your pocket, by defining it as a phone, we end up in really weird legal gray areas, where police officers are allowed to look at things that are on your phone because they're trying to get what seems like some kind of more narrow piece of communication that you were doing. But now they've got access to your entire life. I mean, they're in essence like taking your brain apart. We end up with laws that are defined around doing things with just this device and suddenly don't affect other devices. And so I think this kind of like figuring out how to define and how to name these devices, how we think about them as a user community, I think is actually a very important point. And I'm really glad that somebody like Newt Gingrich cares enough about it to have made a video and have taken a bunch of flack on the internet from a bunch of users in attempting to figure out what we're going to do about that situation. The way in which this issue is complex, though, I think is actually goes even further than what you normally hear. And so I'm going to take a second to talk about some of the ethical issues that are related to it. So going back to all these crazy hacker types. So this is a picture on the left of Charlie Miller. On the upper right is GeoHot. Bottom right is Planet Being, who, if you don't know him specifically, was on the Evaders team, which did the jailbreaks for iOS 6 and 7. Although, frankly, Planet Being has effectively done all the jailbreaks since the beginning of time, except for the one that was done by Comex. To some extent, GeoHot, although he was often competing with Planet Being. The person I'm going to focus on right now, though, is, in fact, Comex. So I'm going to talk about a specific jailbreak called Jailbreak Me. Jailbreak Me is one of the easiest jailbreaks that has ever existed, and it's kind of a name that's been passed down every time we manage to come up with a jailbreak that works like this. It's a web page that you go to on your phone. So you go to the web page in the most elaborate version that has been made, which is the one that Comex did, Jailbreak Me 3, which I almost want to say is like his masterpiece, was a website you went to that looked just like the App Store, and it worked just like the App Store, only the thing that you were installing was Cydia. It had a little button that's free that you clicked on and expanded to install. We don't actually need to listen to that. You click on the free, it expands to install. These are my friends, by the way, who made this video, which is why I'm kind of... click on install. And then the Safari closed. Like, the exploit didn't actually crash the browser. What he did is he took control of the browser, he closes the browser, and then he jumps from the browser into Springboard, and he starts the application installation animation sequence, having Cydia's icon fade in, having a progress bar below it, downloading a copy of Cydia from my website, and then having it get installed on the system in a way where when it's done, it's done. It doesn't actually require you to reboot. It doesn't require you to restart the anything. This was very complicated because he ended up, there were a bunch of file system issues and really highly technical things that he spent months working on this. To give a demonstration of just how crazy Comex is, at some point, Apple fixed one of his bugs. They happened to find the bug. And so for a lot of us, it's like, well, that was the really hard part. That was like the devastating moment, right, where now we have to give up and start over from scratch. But Comex was like, oh, they found my bug. And hours later, he came back and it's like, I've got another bug, I'm still going. We're like, what? But the bug he used is now what I'm gonna focus on for a second. It's a bug in the hinting engine of the FreeType TrueType font renderer. Okay, so fonts are the way that you get glyphs for representing characters on your screen. They have the different shapes of things like whether it be Arial, Times New Roman. The font, when you look at it at really low resolution, looks horrible. So you get this really blurry mess that's very difficult to read. Now, you can either spend a lot of time trying to figure out cute tricks in anti-aliasing. And so one cute trick in anti-aliasing is taking advantage of the fact that if you zoom in really close on an LCD screen, it's not just color. It's always shade of red, shade of green, shade of blue, shade of red, shade of green, shade of blue. And if you turn them all on, you get white. But if you turn off one of them on the edge and you turn on the one on the pixel over, you still get red, green, and blue all next to each other really close. And so you can kind of shift a pixel over by a third of a pixel. And so there are these really complicated algorithms that'll take something blurry like on the top, and we'll try to construct something that has these like shades of red and blue in them that we see on the bottom, that if you were to zoom out would actually look a lot crisper than the original blurry one. But another type of algorithm you'll see is you'll see something called hinting, where you'll take the font character glyph, and you'll take a little hammer and chisel, and you'll start kind of attacking it, and you'll try to make it fit the pixel grid. Now, this might take a really beautiful font that has this wonderful curved component, that this tiny little serif piece at the end, and it'll make it look like this weird demented computer font from like the 1960s. But it makes it readable, and that's what is like the primary concern a lot of people have when they're looking at the font. They don't care if it's pretty, but blurry, I can't read it. It's like, well, it's readable. That's what's important. This hinting algorithm can be font specific. Sometimes for certain kinds of fonts, there are things you want to preserve in the font that are more important than what might, like, than some heuristic might come up with. The way that that's specified is by embedding a computer program in the font that gets run in a virtual machine every time a character gets rendered. So that virtual machine turned out to have a bug in it, which allowed Comex to escape from that virtual machine into Safari's like sandboxed like actual machine, and then he had a bug in the sandbox. He was able to escape from sandbox into Springboard, escaping into the kernel and taking control of the entire system. This bug is a really cool bug, and this bug affects the iPhone, and it allows us to take control of the iPhone, manipulate all of its software. But it doesn't just happen on the iPhone. This is a bug in a program called FreeType. It's an open source implementation of the TrueType font specification that has an implementation of the hinting algorithm that is specified from TrueType. It is the same tool that is used in Foxit Reader. It's the same tool that's used if Firefox has an embedded PDF thing, which I think it does. It's used in Firefox. It's the same one that's used if you have a Linux machine and you are rendering fonts, you are using FreeType to render those fonts, unless they're really ugly. A lot of Apple, like first-party Apple tools that you might have on your desktop Mac, I believe, including Preview, we're using FreeType sometimes, not always. It depends on what exactly they were rendering. Apple also has their own font render. This affected a lot of systems, so there was a lot of collateral damage. So Comex, with the ethical system that he has, which I totally respect for what it's, by the way, I say that, like, I just want to make certain that, like, is that he's going to release a tool, like he's going to release an open source tool. And that's a lot of like hacker mentality is going to release an open source tool. And so he released an open source exploit about the same time. I think it was a little bit later. He didn't actually co-release. I think he may have co-released one of them, but he didn't co-release one of them, I think, where you could just easily take what he did and construct a PDF file that contained an embedded font file that contained an embedded hinting algorithm that would do whatever it is you wanted to do. And so here's somebody who made one for Windows. And so this at the top is a bunch of code that will, if run on outside of a sandbox and arbitrarily on the system, will start the calculator app. That's like the default demo if you're a hacker and you want to demonstrate that you managed to take control of Windows as you start calculator. And at the bottom, we have a snippet of the code from it where he actually had a comment creating the PDF based on the Comex PDF, slightly modified. And he's got Comex PDF template, which was a constant up somewhere else that had the Comex's like PDF file that he had all set up so to make it really easy to drop in whatever exploit you wanted. And now this, if you just open this PDF file in Foxit Reader on a Windows computer, you've calculator spawns. So I sit up here always and I talk about how jailbreaking is this really cool thing where we're going to go and we're going to make modifications to all the software, we're going to change the way all the icons work, we're going to add features and things, we're going to give you stuff that Apple won't give you until a year or two from now. But in a way, jailbreaking is the process of weaponizing exploits of zero-day vulnerabilities, so users might do all of that stuff. It's taking a mistake in code that was designed to make you more secure. It's figuring out how that mistake exists. It's figuring out how that mistake works. It's figuring out how to control that mistake. And it's keeping that mistake secret from everyone who might either be able to fix it or might be harmed by it. And then utilizing that mistake in a massive public manner so that some users might have this cool opportunity to make all of their icons transparent. It's a complex and like it's a complex and thorny ethical issue, and it's something where different people have different opinions on it. So there are people, for example, who are really strongly backing responsible disclosure. There's a person named Jeff Forrestal who actually I work with, and we have very opposite ethics on this in a way, but you know, but it's like he respects what I'm doing and I respect what he's doing. Where you'll find bugs and you'll bring them to the vendor. You'll go to Google and you'll say, I found a bug. I found this master key vulnerability. That's what Jeff Forrestal found last year. And then you'll give them time to fix the vulnerability, which of course, because it's Google, they didn't do. And then you'll, at only months later, will you publicly disclose the vulnerability after it has been, after it has been essentially fixed. And Samsung had gotten a bunch of fixes. He gave them a timeline that he was going to be, it was many months later, he was going to give him talking a black hat. So that's clearly the opposite of what we're doing. So it's like, that's responsible disclosure. What are we doing? Irresponsible disclosure? Well, I will argue that there's a different kind of ethics involved here that are important to think about. So when I look at jailbreaking, I think of children in a weird way. So, and this title, by the way, is the way that I was supposed to cite this picture. And I had to find a picture that I could actually utilize in this context, because it's the kind of thing where it's really like stock photography and everything. And so this is actually a public domain picture that I thought was just, it was a really awesome picture, but it also, arguably, it had this really humorous title associated with it, but I had to put it on the slide. I learned to program way back, I was in the second grade, at my elementary school. And I did it on an Apple IIc, which was running Logo, which was a programming language that has some influences from Lisp and some other programming languages. But it's a language that has like a little fountain pen that can be pen down, pen up, and you can change the color of the pen, and you can move the fountain pen tip around. We had a robotic turtle that came with it that the school had that you could attach to the computer and that would hold a little marker and would move around. And instead of just having like a virtual spirograph, if you ever play with one of those things, the little marker that moves around, we actually had like a physical one we could control. And this was just the most awesome thing. And it really inspired me to do computer programming. But honestly, I didn't, because I didn't have the ability to really do this much at home. In fact, my parents even, they were excited for me. They wanted to support me. They got me an Apple IIe and I kind of played with it for a long time. But I didn't really feel like I became a computer programmer until I got this calculator. This calculator was like required equipment for students in when I was back in like seventh grade or something like that, maybe even sixth grade. And it was something that I continued to have, this calculator or calculators very similar to it. And in fact, students these days still have calculators very similar to this, which is always one of the confusing things. Haven't the calculators gotten better? Why is my iPhone so much more powerful than my calculator that I'm still paying $200 for? But this calculator was programmable, and it was programmable in a language called TI Basic, and it came with a giant manual explaining exactly how TI Basic works, and that was awesome. And it wasn't just so you could write programs sort of for yourself. You could write programs, and then you could plug a cable into your calculator. You could plug a cable into your calculator, plug that cable into somebody else's calculator, and you could transfer your program from one calculator to the other one. And so people would go and they would write games and they would share games with each other. They would write things to help you with math homework, which sometimes math teachers didn't really like. But then they would share those applications around. It's an opportunity where a lot of kids, including myself, really got into computer programming, and for the first time, because it wasn't just computer programming even for us, it was computer programming for us and our audience of friends. And I will argue that today it's the iPod Touch. So the iPod Touch is a very cheap device that is, in essence, a gaming device for a lot of the ways that parents think about it. It is also a productivity device, but it is not a phone, which is something that a lot of parents like. They don't want to give their kid a cell phone, but they will give their kid an iPod Touch. It plays music, and it has all these games and all this other sorts of stuff. It may be that they then feel like maybe I don't have to give them a DS or something like that. The iPod Touch is also very cheap, and the iPod Touch is nearly indestructible, and the iPod Touch is essentially oftentimes a giveaway, a throw-in with other things you'll get. So you'll buy a new MacBook Pro, and it'll come with an iPod Touch, and you'll be like, okay, what am I going to do with this iPod Touch? Well, I didn't really need an iPod Touch, and you'll give it to your kid. Sometimes kids will get the hand-me-downs of the previous generation that the parent had. This is now, in these days, the computer that the child actually owns. And again, I call it a computer, because to me, this is a computer. This is something that is every bit as programmable as my actual computer. And in fact, it's running an operating system that is nearly identical to my actual computer. If you actually go and you start taking apart iOS, you realize that it is OS X. It's using the same surface compositing, font rendering. It's got all the same low-level programming infrastructure as far as the way the standard libraries work, everything. I mean, I drop an SSH server on here and I'm able to SSH into it and treat it like just like I treat my server. In fact, one day I was logged into my iPhone. I wanted to reboot it. I typed reboot. My phone didn't reboot, and I sat there for a little while scratching my head until I realized I just rebooted my server. Because I set them up the same. I mean, the prompts even looked very similar. They just had a different, like, this coloring and everything. So when I look at these devices and I think about the fact that they are kind of being controlled by Apple, they're being centrally controlled by a certificate authority chain where in order to actually deploy software to it, you have to sign paperwork, you have to often pay money in order to get, like, it's $100 in order to get a certificate that allows you to actually code for the device. You can only use that certificate for 1 year. It's something where I'm just looking and I'm seeing that this current generation of computers that children have aren't programmable in the same way that my calculator was, in the same way that that I grew up learning to program. And it really makes me sad. And that's why, to me, it's not clear when you look at the responsible disclosure angle. I almost want to say that sometimes responsible disclosure is unethical disclosure. If you're disclosing things that are removing the ability for our next generation of developers in order to actually learn to develop. So we're going into another DMCA exemption cycle in 2015. So every 3 years, these exemption cycles come up. And the question now again is are we going to be able to expand our exemption? Are we going to be able to keep our exemption? I kind of hope we're going to be able to keep our exemption because we've already gotten it a couple times in a row. And they seem like if you read the comments actually loved the exemption last year. But we got no expansions. We're going to try again for tablets. How are tablets going to be defined? I would really love to try again for computers. There was a group last year, the Software Freedom Law Foundation. I probably got one of those words wrong, but it's the legal group that backs the Free Software Foundation. They tried for computers. I don't really honestly, though, have much hope that we'll actually succeed in something like that. But I think that it can be helped a lot if people like you leave comments. So the way that the process works is that there's an opportunity for people to submit things to become exempt, and typically firms or law affiliate groups that put together these fairly thick documents that try to make arguments both from legal and from economical standpoints about why certain exemptions should exist. But there's then there's an opportunity for response, and then there's this opportunity where just everyone in the general public is able to file comments. Last year, we got hundreds of comments from people in just users who wrote impassioned documents that then there's somebody who actually whose job it is to go through all these at the Library of Congress, and my understanding from talking to people from the EFS is that these comments really make the difference. So I would like to ask you all to please, when this comes up, to write comments. I gave a talk last week where I happened to mention this as a call to action at the end. I really suck at call to actions, by the way, so I was really happy to even have a call to action at all. And he said that this is kind of a useless call to action because I can't leave the comment right now, and I'm going to forget to to file the comment when it actually comes up. So maybe there's some kind of like mailing list you could have me sign up for that I could just like send an email, like get an email from you, because he's talking to me, right? When the call to action occurs. So I set one up quickly. If you go to groups.sorkit.com, this is like an official Google group thing, so you know that I don't even think I can get your email address. All of the subscription and mechanisms for it are like controlled by Google. And if you go there and you click on browse, there's like one mailing list that's listed there, call to action, and you can go and you can, again, it's the normal Google Groups interface. It just has this URL because I use Google Apps to manage everything. Any questions?
Comment, you're awesome.
Thank you. To repeat the comment, he said that I was awesome. Thank you.
Any other questions?
All right.
A lot of the jailbreak apps require...
That's a microphone?
Microphone. Awesome. Sorry, I just got sidetracked
awesome.
Here. Most of the time you need root access to do anything beyond basic stuff. Is there any possibility to allow the basic stuff to be able to have some sort of Cydia that can do things like a shell? You can't modify anything, but you can say, SSH into it, maybe not on port 22 because you need root for that, but maybe 2222 or something.
So
something really
you're asking, is it possible to get some functionality that we have on jailbroken devices instance without jailbreaking? Or I guess
correct,
I'm still
without jailbreaking, like with a cert from Apple. Like,
oh, if you have a certificate from Apple, yeah, you have a lot of options that become open to you as far as being able to. Now the problem is that you can't really have, even with a certificate, you can't have an application spawn another application. So if yeah, that's in the sandbox. The forking mechanism is just totally off limits. So you're gonna have a really difficult time trying to construct like an SSH server on that thing.
Okay.
But like on an Android device, so Android, one of the complaints that I have about it is that everyone looks at it and they're like, oh, it's this open device. If you don't like iPhone, go to an Android. And two complaints. First of all is that, well, honestly, a lot of the kids actually have an iPod. And the second one is that actually the Android devices aren't that open. The ones specifically from Google are relatively open, but they're also very easily destroyed if you mess with them. Whereas like iPhone, like, I mean, I am on the forefront right of all the weird hacks that we're doing, and I get the beta versions of a lot of stuff, and I've only ever come close to bricking a phone once, and we figured out what was wrong with it. Years later, I managed to contact the guy who figured out the thing, and we actually figured out what was wrong with it and fixed it. On an Android device, it's actually very easy to like end up formatting both the recovery partition and the normal partition, and sometimes there's just no good way to flash it anymore. There's no way to get stock ROMs to the device. You're just kind of screwed. And then even if you have, something like a Samsung device or a Motorola device or HTC device, you actually have a very locked down device. And a lot of people buy those devices because those are the ones that are really heavily marketed by the companies that have been doing actual mobile device manufacturing for many years that are actually of quality marketing in addition to quality manufacturing. I was a little bothered with all that stuff. But on the Android device, though, at least if you are in developer mode and you're at least able to run, you can kind of SSH, and it's not SSH, you're using Android debugging shell in order to get in there, but you can even run an SSH server on there at that point. You can fork things. Mm-hmm. But.
Interesting.
Yes?
So, move over a little bit. When I use my phone normally, I don't ever feel constricted with the default settings. Is there anything you would still recommend me to jailbreak it to have the option of?
I find it really difficult without spending some time talking to you to understand how you use your phone to really come up with recommendations, because the types of people who jailbreak their phone and what they jailbreak for tend to be so varied. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I actually don't use themes on my phone. If you look at my phone, I have the stock icons, but that's a really killer feature for a lot of users. For me, the killer features end up being things like controlling incoming phone calls. And so there's this thing called RingerX VIP that allows me to say that my phone doesn't ring unless it's somebody in my address book, or actually most of the time it's like my phone doesn't ring unless it's one of these three people, and I can switch between different profile modes. And text message is a big one, because it's like some people, it's like a text message from that person is critical. It's like my server's offline, whereas this person just texts me constantly in order to tell me what he's doing in the evening. And so I don't want his messages to like, to bug me if I'm on like silent, but I want messages from Britta to always wake me up even if I'm asleep. So,
and another thing, like I use location blocking, so I have my location is Iceland for any application that I don't need location, like a GPS app. I want the real location, but if I don't trust you, I have a different address.
Okay, so I think the woman right behind you, there.
As far as open, like, mobile systems go, Android obviously has the problem where the manufacturers kind of take it over. Are there any good options? I mean, Firefox OS just came out. Ubuntu has something, even though it's not being used much.
Yeah, I would say that there are no good options. There are options that are more open. But the problem is that they're not mainstream, and so they don't have support. They don't have
the adoption.
Yeah, I mean, you end up getting it, and you're like, oh, congratulations. You've possibly spent a lot more in order to get a device that now you can do a lot more on, but now you're not compelled to use it all the time. Whereas, like, my iPhone, I'm using it constantly because it's so useful to me. It's something if you have an Android device, it's the same kind of thing. If it's a website you're using, it's got applications that are related to what you're trying to accomplish. It's actually useful. And now you'd like to be able to do more with it. You get the Firefox operating system, and there's, like, two things you can do with it, and you're on the hook for doing the rest of it, so.
Okay.
I think right behind you, two people. There.
This might be opening a whole Reddit can of worms, but could you comment a little bit on how you feel about competitors to Cydia, and just kind of your general feelings on that subject, and maybe because you kind of have a monopoly on that right now, and I appreciate that, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on it.
The comment about, like, when you use words like monopoly, okay, so the reason why this is coming up is because I wrote an article a few weeks ago talking about community and how community relates to competition. And the issue that I have is that people look at what I do and they see this one thing that's profitable, and they typically what they are is they're a company that's interested in getting involved in the space because they think that there's an opportunity to make a lot of money at it. They see the one thing that I do that's profitable or easy or fun, depending on who the person is doing that, and they say, I want to do that, and then I want to figure out a way to, in essence, like, bleed Sorek out of the ecosystem. They don't, however, take into account the fact that, well, are they going to be here giving a talk to you guys? Are they going to be, are they going to maintain that subreddit that you're on? Because I actually hire moderators to moderate that subreddit. Are they going to run websites like Jailbreak QA? Are they going to run Jailbreak Con, which we've essentially done now for the last 2 years and we now own it? It's something where there's a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes in order to make all of this stuff work. And if you really want my job, you have to take my entire job. You can't just take the one thing that allows me to make money to make the job work. And so that's where the part of that article's goal was to try to explain to people all the different things that I do and try to make it clear that if you want to do this thing, you have to actually replace me. And that's okay. I mean, I've got many other things that I can do. But I think a lot of people they feel like butthurt by it. They're like, oh, you know, Sorek's going to pack up his things and go home. It's like, well, no, Sorek's not going to have any money in order to do all these things. But it's not even really, I also take issue with the word monopoly because Cydia itself is kind of like a meta app store. I mean, you don't have to compete with me. You can make your own repository. I don't require you to sell anything through me. And in fact, the largest products in the ecosystem don't sell through me. They have their own payment systems, like things like Byte SMS, for example. So I'm always just a little bit confused as to what the actual core issue is. I really think that it comes down to just people wanting to, they see an opportunity and they want to utilize it. And so in that particular case, because there was like a particular competitor that had come up. And so I kind of written this article in reaction to the user base, but then they took it as like, because I was like, my examples were actually not even just that company. There were a couple companies I brought up. These people then wrote this like slam piece about me. And so then I was like, well, okay, if you're going to actually like try to drag up all of this stuff, I'm going to actually show what you were saying to all the developers. And when the users read that, you might not even have seen that because it got downvoted so hard and everyone was so angry at that group that it didn't even get any play on the subreddit anymore. But if you go and you dig up, somebody actually has made like a PDF file of all the interactions between all the different groups. You might read that. It becomes much more clear that it's like this is a company who's just trying to make a lot of money off of this space. And by the way, it is actually, when I say it's a company, I mean it's like a startup project by a few med students who probably would not actually be able to take it to term anyway because they're really busy in their like college environment trying to do this side project as an entrepreneurial issue. So I don't know. That's like my full commentary on that. But across.
So if I understood correctly, the Supreme Court recently agreed with Newt Gingrich, after a fashion, by ruling that police need a warrant to search the contents of your cell phone, where, you know, they've arrested you, they can go through your pockets, they can go through your wallet, they can look at your cell phone, but they can't force you without a warrant to disclose the contents of the cell phone. Do you see that has any implications for the conversation that you were having here? Kind of related question, which is, who is defending this, what seems actually like a kind of anachronistic distinction between the iPhone as a phone handset and an iTouch, which is identical to an iPhone except doesn't have the phone functionality, and an iPad, which is identical for the same reasons, it's just bigger, when the hardware manufacturers, I mean, the hardware is distinct, but the software is all exactly the same software, and they sell it that way too.
Okay, so your two questions. Your first question about the Supreme Court decision, which I've not looked at in detail. When I really want to comment on these things, it's when I've really read through all of the court decision, and in some cases, I actually have read through these court decisions. But as far as ramifications, because it's related to the search warrants issue, I doubt that the people who are in charge of that our legislatures really think about those two issues as like the copyright issue and the search warrant issue as identically as I do. In the sense that this is like a computer, and that's really the core issue is about what it means to be a computer. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if it'll have any much direct ramification. I'm glad that they made that decision, however. But again, I haven't read it, so for all I know, I'll actually read the decision, and then I'll be like, oh my god, this is actually horrible, like it got misreported, stuff like that. So your second question, which Oh, it was the iPod Touch. It was who's defending the difference between an iPhone and an iPod Touch? And I almost want to say that no one's really necessarily defending that difference. What people are defending are, because Apple's actually not. Apple provided response negative commentary on the first round of exemptions. They did not even participate this last time. They got bad PR for it the first time, and Apple cares a lot about PR. But also, I think that they realized that this isn't affecting them that much, because it's been an additional 3 years, is over twice as long as we had been doing this in the first place, and it didn't matter as much. I look at the iPod Touch, like, I almost sometimes feel like I'm the only person who cares about the iPod Touch. And in fact, I'm on the EFF track. I talk to the EFF people, and they keep bringing up iPads. And I keep saying, can we stop talking about iPads and concentrate on iPod Touches for a second? Because that's the thing that I think is actually really, really important. Because the iPod Touch and the iPhone are, like, so similar to each other, and yet we get this weird distinction that is run up about whether, like, this wireless telephone handset problem. There doesn't really seem to be anyone fighting against it, except for the fact that it is collateral damage from iPads. Because how do you really define an iPod? Like, when you try to define an iPod, how do you define it that doesn't? It's a 4-inch iPad, right? Like, what's the difference? So you're kind of screwed if you're not allowed to do an iPad because they don't want a Kindle to be included in there. Or what if you have, like, an e-reader that's 4 inches large? Like, what are you going to do with it? So that's the real issue, is just trying to figure out how all these definitions work such that everything gets included the way that we want. Or to really make the point that computers are really the issue, which is really hard, because they don't even want an e-reader to be an issue, and I'm like, that's a computer. So, what are these people over here? The giant orange mic.
My question's about baseband developers. Now that we have most of the solutions to unlock your device to go on the network of your choice are hardware based, the SIM, whatever they call them, you know, the tray that your SIM card sits in, or
the little slot thing.
Whatever you want to call it. They had a term for it. That's your unlock option now. If you have a phone and you want to put it on a network of your choice and the carrier that you bought the phone from doesn't let you, you have a hardware solution. So now that's monetized. There's not a community around it anymore. Back when you had a software unlocks, there was a community behind it. So that leading in my actual question, he was talking about search warrants and things like that. Is there a baseband development community out there to develop a solution to detect and block interception by Stingray devices?
So the baseband, for people who don't know, is like a different system running on your phone. There are, in essence, two CPUs on your phone that are both on the same system on a chip. The second one's nearly as powerful as the first one, but we typically call it a DSP. What it does is it controls the radio interfaces. It controls the Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, and cellular telephone interfaces. It typically also has direct access, and this is where it gets a little more scary, to the microphone and the speaker. And the reason why it does that is because it's going to be doing audio compression directly from the directly from the microphone to the GSM interface, and it's going to be decompressing directly into the speaker. This is something where it is, in essence, totally isolated from the application processor that we normally are able to look at. And so if you were to have some kind of either exploit or backdoor in it, you could, from the cellular network, get access to the phone and listen on the microphone and speaker, and there would actually be no way for the normal operating system to actually determine that anything's happening. We used to spend more time looking at the baseband because we were building software unlocks, and those were based on exploits in the baseband. Software unlocks, which are used to take a phone from, for example, AT&T and put it on T-Mobile, are no longer as important for two reasons. One of which is the one you brought up, which is that we now have this weird, and it's, I actually think, somewhat illegal, honestly, back-end way of getting unlocks, which is like through AT&T. There's like an employee that sits there and like steals them, in essence. And then there's, or the official way through Apple. And then the second reason is that we just honestly haven't had an exploit on the system in a while. And so there's very little knowledge of what's going on in the baseband, very little ability to protect or determine even anything that's going on. And so I know of people who are very interested in the thing that you're talking about, in terms of being able to protect against backdoors and various forms of like back-end intercepts, but I don't know of any real work that's been moved forward on that. So,
I mean, that seems like a big problem, that you don't have a community behind it, because the need for the community to exist disappeared.
Yeah. And but we've got like one more minute, I think. So yes, what's your question?
I had a question of how you think Swift and the development of Swift and integrating Objective-C with that, if it's going to make all of this easier or if it's going to make it more difficult.
In some ways, I think it's going to make it a little bit harder, but I don't think it's going to make it as harder as some people portray. So the question is about Swift. Swift is a much more strongly typed language, and it's got it's like directly compiled in various ways that people have been looking at. Can you even do these kinds of changes? Yes, you can. I love doing these kinds of changes, these kinds of runtimes. During WBDC, I gave a talk actually across the street at AltConf 3 days after the announcement of Swift about how you do this sort of like run low-level manipulation of stuff and like ripping apart the types. So I think we'll be prepared for handling things written in Swift and their modifications.
It seems like it might be easier just because of being able to import the Objective-C.
Well, we can talk about that afterwards if you're really curious about this. But yeah, it's not. It might be easier to like utilize the Objective-C, but the problem is you're working at such a low level when you're making these modifications that it can become confusing. Well, thank you all very much for coming here. If you'd like to ask a question, you can come up to me afterwards, but I'm supposed to stop it right now, so. All right. Thank you.